Chapter 17. I'd agreed to meet James Royce Royce, the other James Royce Royce, during my lunch hour outside an embarrassingly middle-end jeweller's in central London. He turned up exactly on time with baby Jay strapped to his chest, making him look like the world's most wholesome kidnapper. "Do you two ever put him down?" I asked. He blinked at me exactly once. "Yes. Just not in the middle of London." That was fair. The last thing you wanted to do was put your kid down for 5 minutes and then come back to find he'd been detonated by the bomb squad. "So how's..." I found myself pointing at baby Jay. I didn't know how to talk to or about children at the best of times, and mostly I got away with it because I usually encountered them as part of large groups of less crap people who did all the cooing for me. But today, it was just me and baby Jay. Worse, baby Jay was a particularly difficult child to talk about because when the James Royce Royces had first brought him home, he'd looked ever so slightly like something Jim Henson had built out of foam and ping-pong balls. And needless to say, James Royce Royce would keep saying things like, "Isn't he darling? Isn't he the most darling thing you've ever seen?" And I would say things like, "Well, he's quite wet. Are they all this wet?" "He's fine," said James Royce Royce, who, where babies were concerned, was definitely my favourite of the James Royce Royces. I redirected my awkward glance from the child to the jewellers.
Thanks for coming."
"No problem." It had been a little over a week since I'd, you know, accidentally proposed to Oliver in a fit of whatever the hell that had been a fit of. Of course he'd said yes, correctly discerning that if he'd said no, I'd have changed my name, moved to Pluto, and joined the French Foreign Legion. Since then, we'd had one or two short conversations, mostly led by Oliver, and mostly focused on what a sensible choice it was to get married because of next-of-kin benefits and mild tax breaks, which was what happened when, instead of proposing on one knee at the Eiffel Tower, you did it in a kitchen while your partner had his head in a cupboard. And probably meant I owed Oliver not a do-over, exactly, I was never doing that again, but at least a decent ring. Well, the decentish ring I could get on my budget. The decentish ring I could get on my budget, given about 80% of engagement rings were total shit.
"Shall we go in?"
asked James Royce Royce. Yes. The answer was yes. I couldn't get a ring if I didn't go in. Maybe.
"If you don't like this shop, there are three others within 8 minutes' walk, two of them within the same price range."
"It's not the shop. I'm just... I don't know. Nervous, I think."
"That's because you're a commitment phobe."
"With good reason."
"Not with good reason," James Royce Royce told me firmly. "Dogs aren't more likely to bite people who are scared of dogs."
"What? I'm getting married, not a pet." He looked down at baby Jay, who was currently distracted by all the sparkly things in the window.
"You had a bad experience once, and you're afraid it'll happen again. But past performance is no guarantee of future results."
I think that was meant to be reassuring. And if I'd been investing in a stock portfolio, it might have been. Or maybe I was unreassurable right now. After all, part of the reason I'd asked James Royce Royce to come with me, instead of anyone else I could have asked, is that I knew I could rely on him to give me an opinion that wasn't overbearingly romantic, like Bridget or James Royce Royce, or crushingly cynical, like Priya, or, well, me. "Come on then," I said, with about as much conviction as I could summon. "Let's put a ring on it, by which I mean buy a ring that I can give to Oliver, which he can wear if he wants, maybe, if it doesn't need resizing, which it probably will." Pushing open the door, we stepped into that churchy hush that all jewellers seemed to cultivate, as if they were trying to instill a sense of inadequacy that could be dispelled only by spending more than you could afford.
I was instilled with a sense of inadequacy, and my credit was nowhere near good enough to dispel it. To quell my rising panic, I peered into one of the counters, as if I knew what the fuck I was doing. Except I didn't. I wasn't even looking at rings. "Can I help you, sir?" I looked up to see a slender, ashen-faced man in a three-piece suit who somehow looked like he had a pencil moustache while also being completely clean-shaven. I said. The unaccountably intimidating shop assistant folded his hands behind his back.
"And what might sir be looking for?"
Somehow he made sir sound like an insult. "I guess," I tried, "a ring?"
"Estate? Eternity? Wedding? Puzzle? Promise? Semi-mount? Signet? Cocktail? Cluster? Cladder?"
Oh my God, I'd walked into the lair of the riddling jeweller. Any second now he was going to say, "My first is in diamond, but isn't in heart." "Engagement," I squeaked.
"Ah."
In one syllable, he managed to express more disappointment than any of my school teachers or university lecturers had ever managed. I visibly cringed. "Is that okay?" Without another word, he bent at the waist and drew forth a velvet tray that he laid in front of me very much with the air of someone casting pearls before swine. Which, as it turned out, he definitely was. Because, looking at the price tags, I couldn't afford anything.
"Do you..."
I asked, with a disproportionate amount of shame for someone who, at the end of the day, was still about to shell out about 500 quid in this guy's shop. "By any chance have anything cheaper?" The man cleared his throat and took way too long replacing the tray of shit I couldn't afford with a tray of 25-pound cubic zirconia tat. "Oh, come on." I made a gestural, "Oh, come on," to underscore my verbal, "Oh, come on," in the hopes of articulating quite how much of an "Oh, come on" situation this was. "Something in the middle."
"The first tray was in the middle, sir."
I tried to remember that working in customer service was unrewarding and people had to take their entertainment where they could. "Okay, something just under the middle then. Something below average, because I am a below average person, as you have so clearly implied."
"I beg your pardon, sir," said the gaslighting fuck on the other side of the counter.
James Royce Royce stepped forward.
"We want to see a selection of men's engagement rings in the £500 to £800 range."
I don't know how James Royce Royce, despite having a still faintly Muppet-esque baby strapped to his chest, managed to have more gravitas than me, but he did. And approximately 40 seconds later, we were poring over a tray of exactly the type of rings I'd been looking for, in exactly the range of prices I'd been expecting to pay for them. They were, in a lot of ways, quite similar, because this was one of those areas where men's fashions followed some pretty strict rules, though fortunately those rules more or less matched what I knew of Oliver's taste, which was to say classic, masculine, and non-ostentatious. I turned to James Royce Royce.
"How did you..."
I gave a non-specific hand wave.
"For James."
He shrugged.
"It was easy. Got the biggest, shiniest thing I could. Had it custom made."
"Oh, right. Because you're incredibly rich." He shrugged again.
"Not my fault you didn't do a maths degree, Luke."
Welp, he had me there. Once again, I leaned over to inspect the rings in front of me. Between my budget and Oliver's aesthetic, I was able to narrow it down quickly to a gold band, a brushed gold band, a white gold band, a subtly different white gold band, and a white gold band with a thin strip of rose gold running around the middle. There'd also been one with a diamond set in it, one with three diamonds set in it, and one with a faux Celtic motif,
but I discounted those immediately on the grounds that Oliver would have fucking hated them. After a moment of thought, I also discounted the plain and the brushed gold because they'd look too weddingy. And Oliver was kind of traditional in some regards, so I wasn't sure he'd like a gold engagement ring. Okay, I turned to James Royce Royce. Which of these identical rings is least crap?
Excuse me, sir, protested the unaccountably intimidating shop assistant. I can assure you our goods are all of the highest quality.
I glowered at him. Leave it out, this isn't Tiffany's. You've made it very clear that I'm a middle-of-the-road guy, but let's be honest, this is a middle-of-the-road shop.
Sir appears to have taken offence at my manner, the assistant sneered. I beg sir's forgiveness.
Obviously he was banking on sir being too lazy to walk 8 minutes down the road to a shop where sir might be treated less rudely. And he had sir banged to rights. Sir would take a lot more abuse than this if it meant dodging a short walk or a long queue. Having been momentarily distracted by wiping the dribble from Baby J's chin, James Royce Royce took a shufti at the merchandise.
I think that one,
he pointed at the ring with the rose gold detailing,
is the most Oliver. Then again, you know him better than I do.
I did, but he was completely right. Of course, the competition was two completely boring rings with no decoration whatsoever, but Oliver was definitely a subtle seam of rose gold kind of guy. I'll take it, I said, and if my fiancé needs to come in to get it resized, I want you to be nicer to him. Despite being quite a lot shorter than I was, the assistant somehow managed to look down his nose at me.
I shall endeavour to accede to sir's wishes.
Although now I thought about it, Oliver had nothing to fear from this guy, because he very much came across as white suit, nice hat, Julia Roberts, whereas I was more thigh-high boots with a safety pin, Julia Roberts. In any case, I forked over my 700 quid, pocketed the ominous velvet box, and got the fuck out of there. The velvet box was still ominousing in my pocket at the point our evening reached the me on the sofa watching old seasons of American Horror Story and Oliver on the floor with his laptop and his case notes being all hot and diligent stage. Oliver, I said, at the same time he said, Lucien. And then I said, no, you. And he said, after you. And we went back and forth like that for a bit, until Oliver managed to squeeze in and, I think we should talk about the wedding. And I squeezed back a, me too. Then we sat there in silence for about a million years. Can I? I tried. At the same time, Oliver said, do you? And this time I followed up quickly with, okay, I'll go. I did not go. Eventually, Oliver cleared his throat.
You know that anything you need to say will... We can. It'll be fine.
I guess... Why was I so bad at this? I guess I just think I... didn't really think it through.
Oliver closed his laptop in a we are now having a serious conversation way.
It's all right, Lucien. I understand.
I'm sure you do, but that doesn't mean it was right for me to ask you to marry me when you had your head in a cupboard.
I confess, he confessed, I was caught a little off guard.
Yeah. So, I fumbled in my pocket for the ominous box. Couldn't find it. Fumbled in a different pocket, dropped to one knee a bit too hastily so it just looked like I'd fallen off the sofa, which had happened more than once, and then finished up with, ow, I mean...
Are you all right?
A very concerned Oliver got to his feet to help me up, and then stared, with a non-flattering amount of confusion,
at the velvet box of doom I was shakily holding out to him. Well, I banged my leg, but, Oliver David Blackwood, now that you're not in a cupboard, will you marry me?
Oliver went through a range of expressions, none of which I could readily identify, and at least some of which I was pretty sure were positive.
I thought I'd already agreed to that when I was in the cupboard. I assumed you were trying to call it off.
What? No. I gazed at him in mounting horror, with the moderately affordable ring hovering between us. Why did you think that?
Several reasons, Lucien. It was quite an impulsive thing to do in the first place. We've barely spoken about it since, and you literally just said you'd made a mistake.
I cringed. Okay, I can retrospectively see how that might have given you the wrong impression, but... I took a deep breath. When I said I made a mistake, I meant that I didn't propose in a very romantic way, or in a way that expressed how great you are, and how, like, feelings you make me.
Looking only a little bit as if I'd offered him a live snake, Oliver took the box and opened it. For a moment he stared at the distinctly average ring. Then, "It's beautiful," he said. "Thank you."
And then slipped it on his finger, and, "Oh my God!" I cried. "It fits!"
Oliver looked down at his hand, half wrapped, as though he almost didn't recognize it. "Yes. Yes, it does."
"And," I added, "it doesn't look awful."
He gave a little blink. "No. No, it looks wonderful."
It did kind of look wonderful. And he looked wonderful wearing it. Because it was like this little piece of Oliver Blackwood was very visibly mine.
Eventually, we noticed that I was still on one knee, and Oliver was still standing, and it created a weird dynamic. So Oliver sat down on the sofa, and I sat down beside him, my eyes flicking every now and again to... "Nice ring," I said. He normally didn't descend to my level, but tonight he smirked. "I've had no complaints." Then he grew quiet. "About the... He cleared his throat. "Wedding. I spoke to my parents today."
Oh dear. For some reason, Oliver's parents had never liked me. I wasn't sure if it was because of the way I dressed, or the fact that my own parents were rock stars, or if it possibly had something to do with that one time I told them to go fuck themselves at their Ruby anniversary. I'd met them a couple of times since, and I'd been marginally better behaved, but the cloud of go fuck yourself had trailed behind me like a fart on the way out of a lift. For the first year, they'd clearly been biding their time on the assumption that Oliver would come to his senses and dump me, much, to be fair, as I had. But when it had become clear I wasn't going away anytime soon, they'd come to accept me the way one might accept a piece of spinach between a dinner guest's teeth. They knew I was there, but, for the sake of their continued happiness, pretended I wasn't.
"And," I asked nervously, "how did that go?" "They said they'd support me in whatever decision I made." I winced.
"Bad as that, huh?"
"I'm afraid so."
I mean... I didn't even know what I was trying to say. I wanted to be supportive of Oliver, but I didn't really want to spend the next however many months tiptoeing around David and Miriam while they, by infuriatingly either their presence or their absence, made me marrying Oliver all about them.
"We can... I mean... do they..." To my relief, Oliver cut me off. "Let's just not think about it for now." Except I wasn't sure that made it better. Especially because Oliver was terrible at just not thinking about things.
and my ability to just not think about things scaled proportionately with how important that thing was to think about. Meaning, I was great at ignoring bills, and hopelessly unable to ignore mean things people said on the internet. You know I am always on side with hiding from problems in the hope they'll go away.
That's not what I'm doing, Lucien, said Oliver, sharply.
It was a bit like what he was doing. But Oliver had been seeing a trained professional for nearly 2 years because of his parents, so I did my best to be sensitive and not poke anything that might be the emotional equivalent of a bear, or a mine, or a bear mine, which would be a bear that would maul you and then explode. I held my hands up in a don't maul me or explode way. All right, just, this is supposed to be about our happiness, and so you need to think about that, instead of, you know, what your mum and dad will say.
Some of the tension faded from Oliver's jaw. I will. Thank you.
Well, that was super convincing, but I knew it was all I was going to get.
In any case, he went on, making a visible effort to smile, I presume Odile was far more enthusiastic.
Oh, fuck me with a rusty coat hanger. I'd somehow managed to not tell her. She was going to kill me. Oliver was going...
Okay, he wouldn't kill me, but he might take it as a bad sign, ring or no ring, that I'd forgotten to mention the most important thing in my life to the most important person in my life.
Joint most important person. Second most important person? Yeah, I overcompensated. She was really excited.
For whatever reason, presumably because he still had a head full of disapproval, Oliver didn't notice that I was talking like I was reading cue cards. I'm glad. I assume we'll be seeing her tomorrow?
Oh, fuck me with a rusty coat hanger covered in sriracha sauce. We saw Mum and Judy a couple of times a month, so I should probably have thought of that before pretending to Oliver that I'd told them something I hadn't told them and needed to tell them in person and wouldn't see them in person until I next saw them with Oliver. And all I needed to have said was, actually, I was waiting until we next went to visit so we could tell her together. But instead, I was starting my engagement, drowning in lies. Chapter 18. The next day, we were standing in Pucklethroop in the Wold, waiting for my mum to let us in, and I still hadn't worked out what to do about the fact that I'd lied to Oliver. The door opened.
"Hello, Luc Mont,"
was as far as Mum managed to get, before I threw my arms around her. "Mum," I cried, then whispered, "Oliver and I are getting married, and he thinks I've already told you," desperately into her ear. She made an, "Ah, I understand," noise, and letting go of me, immediately embraced Oliver with a loud,
"Congratulations on the wedding. I was so pleased to hear about it when Luc told me that it was happening, which he did several days ago."
"Thank you, Odile," said Oliver.
"Oh, you will have to stop calling me that now you are getting married. You will have to call me Maman."
This was going to be a long evening. "Mum, I don't even call you Maman."
"That,"
she glowered at me gallically,
"is because you have no respect for your heritage."
I was about to deliver a fantastically clever and witty reply when the sound of barking echoed from inside and four ecstatic spaniels burst from the hallway. I say ecstatic, but they were, of course, ecstatic to see Oliver, who was great with dogs, and not at all interested in seeing me, who they'd known their entire lives. On the plus side, Oliver did look incredibly cute, kneeling down to receive an armful of fur and puppy dog eyes.
"Charles," he said, bestowing scratches, pets and scruffles. "Camilla, Michael of Kent. Hello, Eugenie, old girl. Who's a good girl? You are. Yes, you are."
I never worked out how Oliver, or for that matter anyone else, was able to tell the dogs apart. Once Oliver had finished greeting the Waffles, as he occasionally and embarrassingly called them, all seven of us went through to the front room.
Judy,
Mum announced,
look who is here. It is Luke and his fiancée Oliver, who, as you know, he has told us he is engaged to.
I sort of liked that Mum was bad at deception. Judy, however, as a result of a great many aspects of her tumultuous life history, had no problem with it at all.
Ah, of course.
She beamed.
Congratulations, old boys. Meant to bring you a gift, but it's fattening up in the lower pasture.
You know, said Oliver, incredibly gently, I am still a vegan.
It wasn't much of a protest, but it was more than he would have managed 2 years ago.
Not to worry.
Judy seldom let go of an idea once it was in her head.
Keep it in the garden. Good for the grass.
I wasn't sure why I was getting into the details of this, given that the non-specific animal in question was almost certainly fictional, but I couldn't quite help myself. You realise I live in a top-floor flat, and Oliver's garden is about 8 feet across.
Well, that changes things.
Sitting back, Judy stroked her chin thoughtfully.
I'll have to give you a goat instead.
I was beginning to feel like I was in one of those improv games where you had to keep saying yes and to whatever your partner came up with. I don't think we've got room for a goat either.
Don't be silly,
Judy told me, undaunted.
Everyone's got room for a goat. They're tiny, practically stackable.
Thankfully, and I use this word advisedly, Mum came to my rescue.
Judy, stop talking about the marvellous wedding present you are getting them for the wedding you definitely knew about. We are here to eat the extra special vegan special curry.
Mum, I interrupted, have you remembered Gruyere is still not vegan? She shrugged.
I found the vegan cheese. You can buy vegan everything these days. You can even buy the vegan bacon. I said, I thought vegans did not like bacon. Why make bacon for people who do not like bacon?
It's not about liking or not liking. I was hoping my unfailing support of my boyfriend's dietary choices balanced out my entirely failing to tell my mum we were engaged. It's about ethics. Like when you were protesting against nuclear weapons in the 80s. A look of worrying comprehension crossed Mum's face.
Oh, so he does it to get laid?
Yes, said Oliver, as he despannelled the sofa. My refusal to drink milkshake brings all the boys to the yard.
Well,
returned Mum,
since, as I already knew, you are engaged now, you need to have only one boy in your yard.
It was at about this point that Oliver's inability to contradict authority figures clashed terminally with Mum's inability to lie. He turned to me.
Would I be completely out of line in thinking you hadn't actually told your mother we were getting married at all?
What?
Cried Mum, valiantly.
No, that is outrageous. Why would I have said so many times that Luke had told me you were getting married if he had not told me you were getting married? How could I possibly have known?
Oliver was looking unconvinced, but also, and this was the important bit, unfurious.
And what about the goat?
Mum had clearly decided she was going down with the ship.
How could Judy have arranged a goat for the wedding if she had not already heard about the wedding?
Having created a small oasis in a sea of dog, Oliver sat down and was immediately re-dogged.
Call me a cynic, but it has crossed my mind that the goat might be imaginary.
Don't be silly, Oliver. How can you give somebody an imaginary goat?
I folded myself onto the floor next to Oliver and put my head in my hands. Mum, it's fine. Thanks for covering for me, but you need to stop helping now. Mum's attitude shifted in a nanosecond.
In which case, Luke, I need you to know that I am very offended.
I'm sorry I didn't tell you, I mumbled. I meant to, but it was kind of a sudden thing, and I wanted to do it in person, but then I accidentally told Oliver I already had.
Yes,
that was Oliver.
Why did you do that, Lucien?
My head was staying in my hands. It seemed the best place for it. Well, you'd told your parents, so I was worried you'd think if I hadn't told Mum it would mean, I don't know, something.
It means,
Mum said,
that Oliver is a better son than you are.
I looked up. Then that's fine, because you've got him now. Mum considered this.
That is a fair point.
She sat down on the sofa and put her arm around Oliver.
Luke, this is Oliver. He is my son. He is a very nice boy. He has a good job and always calls his mother. Oliver?
She gestured contemptuously at me with her free hand.
This is some ungrateful shit who sometimes comes to my house and eats my curry and complains about it.
Mum, I protested, definitely not sounding like a teenager. I'm really sorry. There's been a lot going on recently. She tossed her head.
How would I know? You never talk to me.
I talk to you all the time. I just didn't mention this one thing.
To be fair,
put in Judy,
it is quite a significant thing. I told my parents about most of my marriages.
You see,
exclaimed Mum,
and Judy was a terrible daughter. She gave her father 3 heart attacks.
I sighed. Fine, I'm a terrible son.
You were a terrible son,
Mum corrected me.
Oliver is my son now.
Oliver had a faintly panicked look in his eyes, a look that was slowly spreading to the rest of his face. What he still didn't quite get about my relationship with Mum was that we sort of upset each other all the time, sometimes over huge things like, me not telling her I was getting married, sometimes over tiny things, like whether the guy who used to live next door to us when I was 12 was called Jim or John. It was just that it didn't mean anything, because she was my mum, and despite what she was saying right now, I was her son, and we loved each other, and always would.
I don't think it's a trade, he said. I think it's more a jointly and severally liable kind of deal.
Mum smiled beatifically.
Oh, it is so nice having a son who is a barrister. He always says intelligent things, instead of insisting the guy next door used to be called John.
Hang on. I actually jumped to my feet in a moment of strong emotion. I never said he was called John. You said he was called John.
I did not say he was called John, Mum insisted. I said he was called Jim, because that was his name. But you never listened to me as well as never telling me anything.
No, you didn't. You said his name was John, and you remembered specifically because of the Beatles. Mum shook her head.
No, that was our other neighbour, Mr. Starkey. In any case,
she rose majestically from the sofa.
I should serve up the extra special vegan special curry before the artichoke goes soggy.
This was Oliver's cue to go through to the kitchen and help, Eugenie's cue to follow him, and my cue to sit in the living room, having a bizarre conversation with Judy. So, I began, how's things? She absently lifted a spaniel out of the fireplace.
Not bad. Can't complain. Went to see a chap the other day to see if I could have the use of his cock.
And how did that go?
Very disappointing. He'd sent me a picture of it, but it turns out that wasn't his cock at all. Belonged to another fellow. And you could tell immediately. Much smaller, head a completely different shape, and it was bobbing up and down quite erratically.
It happens, I said. Judy gave an indignant snort.
Not to me, it doesn't. Why is it, when you get to a certain age, chaps think you'll take any cock they offer you? I mean, I said to him, Sir, I have handled many cocks in my time, and that is by far the scrawniest, scraggiest, least satisfying specimen I've ever...
It was at that moment that, to my mild relief, Mum poked her head round the door.
Oh, by the way, mon canton, though I am still very angry with you, I should also say that I am over the moon for you and Oliver. Obviously, my own wedding was a cocaine-fueled rager, and my husband was a piece of shit who fucked 3 of the bridesmaids. But I am sure things will be different for you.
I suppose, I said. There'll be less cocaine, and I'm pretty sure Oliver won't want to have sex with any of the bridesmaids. Mum nodded sagely.
It is one of the advantages of being a gay.
I let that one slide. I think it's also an advantage of marrying somebody who isn't a complete arsehole.
I suppose that might also be part of it. But are you absolutely sure about the cocaine? Because if you did want some, I am certain I could arrange it.
There were few things of which I was absolutely surer. No cocaine. Also, you don't have to arrange anything. For a moment, I was worried I'd offended Mum again.
But of course I will arrange things. You are my son. You are supposed to plan your son's wedding. You are also supposed to pay for your son's wedding.
Technically, that's daughter's, pointed out Judy. Which was a bit rough on my old man, what with my having so many. Still, the bugger owned half the home counties, so he could afford it.
I don't have any daughters,
Mum replied.
And anyway, Luke is a gay, so...
Can we please not have the gay as a noun conversation again? I asked. Mum shook her head.
Not now, Luke. This is very important.
It took me a moment to realise that the very important thing that she was discussing was why it was okay for her to take over my and Oliver's wedding. Slow down a minute. It's generous of you, Mum, but we really don't need you to pay for anything.
Well, I was just speaking to Oliver, and he said it was very kind of me.
Yes, but that's because in his world, it's very kind of you is code for I'm too polite to say no. Bearing four bowls of extra special vegan special curry, with a dexterity that should have been impossible for anybody who hadn't been a professional waiter, Oliver emerged from the kitchen.
Did I hear my name?
I was just explaining to Luke,
said Mum, before I could get a word in edgeways,
that you were very happy for me to pay for your wedding.
Actually,
he started handing out curry.
I'm afraid Lucien's right. What I said was that it was very kind of you, which is true, but doesn't technically signal approval. You see, there are also downsides to having a son who's a lawyer.
Mum sighed.
So I am seeing. Bon, I have swapped you back.
Still not a swapping situation, I reminded her. She ignored me.
Stop trying to change the subject. Why do you not want me to pay for the wedding? I am old, I am rich, and I want to be part of your special day.
You will be part of my special day, I told her. You can walk me down the aisle or something. But I wouldn't feel comfortable taking your money, and you're not buying me cocaine. She folded her arms stubbornly.
Luke, if anyone is going to buy you cocaine, it should be your mother. I know the best kinds. I know the best people.
Of course. A lot of them are dead because, well, cocaine dealers, they often have very unhealthy lifestyles, long hours, bad diets, and it's a very stressful business.
We have some savings.
That was Oliver poking nervously at the extra special vegan special curry.
At least I have some savings. Lucien made the mistake of going into the charitable sector.
Well, that is even worse,
cried Mum.
That means Oliver is paying for the old thing like you are one of those brides that you order through the mail.
I scrutinised this analogy from every angle to try and find one that was flattering. It's not like that at all. It's just Oliver's got slightly more money than me and... Okay, it was sounding a tiny bit like that. And anyway, I finished, trying to steer us in a different direction. It's going to be a small ceremony. Just friends and family. And I don't have that many friends or like half my family. Thinking about it, we hadn't actually discussed the size of the ceremony, or the date of the ceremony, the location of the ceremony, or anything about the ceremony at all.
Then,
Mum went on relentlessly,
if it is going to be so very small, it does not matter if I pay for it.
Putting aside the extra special vegan special curry, which always managed to be worse than the regular special curry because Mum took it as license to indulge her creative side, I tried to have an intense debate with Oliver about whether we should let this happen. Except, since I couldn't talk, I was forced to rely entirely on my eyebrows and nose. Unsurprisingly, we failed to reach a firm conclusion. "Can we," I asked, "think about it?"
"Well, of course you can think about it," said Mum. "I'm not a monster. To be honest, I only brought it up now so that I could tell Oliver before I told you, so you would know how it feels."
She paused.
"It does not feel good, does it, Luke?"
I sighed. "No, it doesn't feel good. I'm really sorry."
"You are forgiven."
She took her place on the sofa next to Oliver.
"But the man next door, he was definitely called John."
Part 3. Alexander Anthony Fitzrovia James Twaddle and Clara Isabella Fortescue Lettuce, Coombe Camden Cathedral, Coombe Camden, 4th of September. Chapter 19. When Alex had invited me to his wedding, I'd been not pleased exactly, because weddings were a faff, but at least mildly cheered. It was, after all, nice in abstract to know that a co-worker thought well enough of you to add you to the list of people he wanted around him on the happiest day of his life. Although, given the circles Alex and Miffy moved in, I suspected that the list wasn't exactly short. And a couple of months later, when Rhys Jones-Bowen had suggested that since the entire office was invited, it would make sense to rent a minibus and drive everyone up together, I'd found that mildly cheering too. Then, when he'd added that his friend had given us the use of his house to stay in the night before, so we didn't have to get up stupidly early to be on time for the ceremony, I was relieved. Because it was always good when somebody else took care of the logistics for you. It seemed like the lowest stress, big event wedding I could possibly imagine. All I had to do was show up with Oliver at the end of work, and then we could all pile into a bus like we were going on a school trip. It felt, as Alex himself might have put it, jolly. Except once we were half an hour into the journey, I remembered that I hated school trips. They involved putting a bunch of people who only knew each other in a very specific context into a very different context and expecting everything to work. And it never did. We started out okay, with everybody upbeat and pally and helping each other load their luggage. But things quickly cooled off after we realised that most of us had brought somebody we knew better than we knew the rest of the group, meaning there was no real reason for us to interact as a group. Then they cooled off even more, as each pair realised that most of the things they'd normally talk to each other about were things they didn't particularly want to be airing in a crowded vehicle full of people who were strangers to one half of the couple and professional acquaintances to the other. Even that would have been bearable. But then, Rhys Jones-Bowen insisted on starting a sing-along.
"Come on, you lot," he tried,
with the kind of valour that led brigades of soldiers into valleys full of cannon.
"You're being a right bunch of gloomy gusses. Everybody join in after me. The wheels on the bus go round and round, round and round, round and round."
"Isn't that a children's song?" I asked.
"Well, yes, but I don't see why that's causing you problems."
Rhys kept his eyes on the road, but gave me a very expressive look with his shoulders.
"Unless you've forgotten the words."
Was I letting myself get sucked into a conversation I couldn't get out of again? "I think it's more just a bit embarrassing."
"And I think that says more about you than it does about the song,"
Rhys insisted. From the back seat, Barbara Clench briefly stopped making out with Gabriel, her unfeasibly attractive, much younger husband.
"I agree with Luke. We're adults. We shouldn't be singing nursery rhymes. It's inappropriate." "Only if you sing them to lure children into your van," said Reese's date.
Her name was Anna with one N, and he said he'd met her on the social media. Given that, like many of Reese's dates, she was bizarrely hot and carried herself in a way that suggested she had incredible body confidence, I suspected he'd met her on one social medium in particular.
Otherwise, it's just singing.
Beside me, Oliver had that gleam in his eye he sometimes got when he switched into good at joining in mode.
What if you're singing, but a child hears you and gets lured accidentally?
You're the lawyer, Rhys Jones-Bowen pointed out. You tell us.
Well, I think it would be hard to establish mens rea, but you still might have to answer some very awkward questions.
No children's songs,
Barbara Clench repeated.
What if we do the dirty version? Asked Rhys. Wouldn't be a children's song then.
I was getting sucked in. One more question and I'd be trapped in a vortex of inanity I couldn't escape. Is there a dirty version?
There's always a dirty version.
Rhys was speaking with the certainty of a man who knew most of them. Shloop, went the vortex. But wheels on the bus. What is it? Like the penis on the bus goes flip, flip, flop? Rhys shoulder nodded.
Something like that, yeah.
I am certainly not singing the dirty versions of any children's songs.
Barbara Clench had a bit between her teeth, and normally in this kind of situation, I would get rapidly out of her way. Except I couldn't, because we were stuck in a moving vehicle. Professor Fairclough had been staring out of the window, largely ignoring us, or at least processing everything we were saying on a higher level. Now she praying mantised her head back towards the rest of us.
I'm not sure I do know the words, actually.
How can you not know the words to the Wheels on the Bus song? I asked.
How can you not know the Latin name of the common fruit fly?
Returned Dr. Fairclough. Oliver leaned over to me and whispered, Drosophila melanogaster, in my ear. Dropsophila melanogaster? I tried, which earned a sharp humph from the professor.
To be fair, said Anna with one N, the lyrics are a bit controversial.
Why? I wondered aloud. Is there some hidden meaning to the wipers on the bus go swish, swish, swish that I've been missing my whole life? She laughed. Honestly, she probably laughed more than the joke deserved, but she was clearly on wedding date behaviour.
No, it's just that a lot of kids these days learn their nursery rhymes from YouTube videos, so they get the American version.
I wasn't sure I wanted to know. What's the American version?
Instead of the bits of the bus doing their things all day long, they do them all through the town,
she explained. For a moment that helped, because while we couldn't agree on what to talk about, what to sing, or if singing was even a good idea, we were completely agreed that putting the words all through the town in the Wheels on the Bus song was absolute fucking blasphemy.
How do you know so much about it?
Inquired Barbara Clench in a moment of rare humanity. Anna, with one N, craned her neck back to look at the rest of us.
I used to be a primary school teacher. Used to be?
Coming from Barbara Clench, that question had a not-going-to-end-well quality.
Yeah, now I take my clothes off on the internet.
For a woman who, by the looks of her husband, had a full and active sex life, Barbara Clench could be difficult about this kind of thing. Her lips got very thin.
Don't you find that rather degrading? Sort of,
Anna with one N admitted.
I mean, when you think about it, there's something pretty degrading about the fact that I went to university, did 2 degrees and a professional qualification, spent 3 years working 70-hour weeks with disadvantaged children, and at the end had nothing to show for it but crushing debts and a few nice thank you cards.
She took a deep breath. It sounded like she did this rant a lot.
So I decided that if the choice was getting wanked over by strangers or fucked over by the Department for Education, I'd pick the one that paid better.
There was complete silence in the bus, while Barbara radiated the kind of stifling disapproval that you could radiate only after a lifetime of never bothering to examine a single preconception. A silence that persisted until Oliver, in his best peacemaker's voice, said,
What if we try London Bridges falling down instead?
2 hours into a 4-hour journey, we stopped at a service station so that Rhys could have, in his own words, a slash and a sarnie. I took the opportunity to stretch my legs and grabbed one of the family-sized bags of Skittles that they were, for some unfathomable reason, selling at a discount in WH Smith. Once we'd taken our welcome break at the welcome break, we piled back into the minibus for the second and, as it turned out, more complicated part of the journey. Coombe Camden, the technically a city because it had a cathedral, even though it was actually tiny, of which Miffy's father was apparently Earl, was situated a little way south of Liverpool, right by the Welsh border. But Rhys's mate's house was a little way west of that, and a fair distance into the countryside. Which meant that we spent the next very long time on narrow, windy roads, occasionally blocked by sheep, trying to navigate by a bickering consensus of low-resolution sat-nav, poorly understood maps, and guesswork. The rain didn't help. It had started drizzling as we passed Birmingham. By the time we hit Stoke-on-Trent, that had upgraded to pissing down. And once we left the M40 and were into the bit of the country where there were hedges instead of pavements, and everywhere was called something like Mucklestone or Wetwood, it was raining so hard that the windscreen wipers were just making ripples on a pond. Eventually, Rhys pulled over on a stretch of grass that I wasn't totally sure he should have been pulling over on, but was too much of a city boy to challenge, and announced, "Here we are," with thoroughly unearned cheerfulness. "Where is here, exactly?" I asked.
"Charlie's house."
I peered out of the window, but between the rain and the fact that the sun had set an hour ago, I couldn't make out anything except wet and bush.
"Are you absolutely certain?"
Rhys tapped his phone, which was showing a little blue circle inside a big blue circle.
"Google Maps never lies."
"No," I admitted, "but it's sometimes very economical with the truth." Oliver patted me gently on the leg.
"Perhaps one of us should get out and take a look."
One of us, we all knew, meant Oliver. I certainly wasn't about to go, and Rhys didn't seem to be up for it either. Besides, getting your bearings after a long minibus journey seemed far more like Oliver's skill set than mine, in that it was a useful life skill rather than the brand of occasionally helpful bullshit that I preferred to trade in. Clambering past me and out through the front of the bus, Oliver vanished into the night, only to return a few moments later, with his hair plastered to his head, his jacket wet through, and his trousers damp to the shins.
"There is a house there," he confirmed, "but it's on the other side of a rather large field."
"Ah, that'll be it."
Rhys's aura of cheeriness had never really gone away, but it had ebbed slightly when it had looked like we might be stuck in the dark and houseless. Now it was flowing back with a vengeance.
"The Google Maps do that sometimes in the countryside. They put you in the right general place, but they can't work out where the roads go. I suppose it's because they're hard to see from space."
Anna, with one N, reached out an affectionate hand.
"I'm not sure that's quite how sat-nav works, sweetheart."
"Either way, it seems to be our best option," said Oliver. "So I suppose we should all grab our things and get going."
At the back of the bus, Barbara Clench glowered.
"This was not a well-planned excursion."
Rhys was still grinning.
"No, but it's been an adventure, hasn't it?"
"I'm not sure got wet walking across a field counts as an adventure," I pointed out.
"You know the difference between you and me, Luke?" asked Rhys.
And before I could reply, he said,
"Attitude. If I want to have an adventure, I'll bloody well have an adventure."
While everyone was disembarking and Rhys was locking up the minibus, I checked our surroundings. We'd pulled into a sort of dip in the hedgerow, next to a gate that was very firmly chained shut. Up and down the road I could see precisely nothing, except water and darkness. On the other side of the gate I could see... I mean, I assumed it was a field, but the way the moonlight was gleaming off the surface made it look almost like a lake.
A big square lake with a cottage on the other side of it. "The plan," I yelled over the increasingly insistent sound of the rain. "Absolutely can't be to wade across that." I pointed at the aqua field. "To get to that." I pointed at the cottage.
"I agree with Luke," said Barbara Clench.
She'd agree with me on something about once a year. I think she just did it to throw me off.
"We'd be better off in the bus."
Anna, with one end, shrugged.
"The absolute worst plan is to stand here debating. Come on."
With her jacket over her head and her overnight bag under one arm, she clambered over the fence and set off. To my relief, she wasn't immediately swallowed by a hidden bog. The water actually only seemed to come up to her ankles. But I wasn't particularly keen to follow her. Rhys, of course, was, which I suspected was only partly because they were dating, and mostly because he was the kind of person who genuinely enjoyed doing this kind of thing. I gave Oliver a pleading look. "Is it too late to go home?"
"Significantly, I'm afraid."
Taking me by the hand, Oliver climbed elegantly over the fence, and then waited for me to do the same. Well, to do the same in that I also climbed, but I was way less elegant about it. Squelching down on the other side, I let Oliver wrap his free arm around me, leaned my head against him, and tried to believe that Rhys was right and that this was an adventure, not just a gigantic pain in the arse. Chapter 20. Rhys had not been right. This was not an adventure. My feet were wet. I was trying really hard not to think about what happened when you partially flooded a field full of cowpats, and like most bits of the countryside in the dark, the house was much farther away than it seemed. Or I walked much slower than I thought. One of the two. Probably the second one. I was both tired and unfit. Rhys found the key under the mat, because apparently we were in a part of the world where you could still do that without having your TV stolen, and we all hurried very gratefully inside. Well, nearly all.
"I'll join you soon,"
said Professor Fairclough. She was at least as drenched as any of us, but it didn't seem to faze her at all. Hell, it made her look like the heroine at the end of a romantic comedy, waiting for some jerk to show up and do a big apology scene at her.
"Large areas of stagnant water attract mosquitoes, and I'm interested in observing how the weather affects their behaviour."
"Have a nice time, then," said Rhys,
who seemed to have decided that since this was his friend's house, he was host by proxy.
"Everybody else? Who fancies a cuppa?"
Cuppas were duly provided. A dubious advantage of having worked with the same pack of misfits for more than 5 years was that everybody knew how everybody else liked their tea. Of course, none of us ever actually bothered to put that knowledge into practice, but I preferred to think it was sort of an unspoken pact we had, like the opposite of buying a round at the bar. I won't complain if you put too much milk in, if you don't complain that I let it stew too long. We dumped our coats in the hall and our bags under the stairs, then settled down in the sitting room to dry off. Whoever Rhys's friend was, he'd done well for himself, because he'd wound up with a cosy little cottage in the borders, with an inglenook fireplace, exposed beams, and tastefully chosen furniture. I flopped down in an armchair with Oliver sitting in front of me, his back resting against my knees. "I admit," I said, "it was tough getting here, but this is pretty okay."
"You've got to realise,"
Rhys turned to Anna with one N,
"that pretty okay is about the closest Luke ever gets to being nice about anything."
Anna with one N made an, "oh, that makes sense" kind of noise that I'd have been offended by if it hadn't been totally fair. "What does this Charlie guy do anyway?" I asked.
"He's in something,"
explained Rhys, in a not very explanatory sort of way.
"Broadmoor,"
suggested Barbara Clench, who was occupied with Gabriel. As far as I could tell, Gabriel's role in their marriage basically involved standing around looking decorative, being disproportionately into Barbara, and letting her do most of the talking. Rhys shook his head.
Consulting, I think.
I sipped my tea and did my best to enjoy the atmosphere. We were, after all, in a nice house, and listening to rain drumming on the windows was always relaxing. Still, I said, it's a shame Miffy's dad couldn't have been Earl of somewhere more convenient. Barbara nodded. If she was going to keep being on my side about things, I was going to need to see a doctor, because something was clearly wrong with me.
Yes, I hope you'll be more considerate when you're picking a venue for your wedding.
Our wedding? I asked. Rhys rolled his eyes.
Oh, not you as well. I thought it was only Alex who forgot he was getting married.
No, I remember I'm getting married, I began. And then the realization crept up on me that this conversation was about to go to a very uncomfortable place. I just wasn't sure what you meant about a considerate venue.
Well, you've got to admit, Luke, said Rhys. It's been a lovely trip, but it was a bit of a palaver.
Definitely going to an uncomfortable place. Yes, I agree with that. It's just that our wedding isn't necessarily... We're not going to necessarily...
You're both local, though, aren't you? Observed Rhys. To London, I mean, not to here. So I'm assuming you'll be having the ceremony somewhere everybody can get to easily.
Yes. This wasn't going well. For everybody who's invited, it's just...
It's just we haven't discussed the guest list in detail, said Oliver, who was always way better at being diplomatic than I was. And a lot of the venues we're looking at are rather small.
Even though Oliver had been the one to say it, or rather imply it strongly enough that they got the hint, they all turned to me.
I hope...
There was a genuine tremor in Rhys Jones-Bowen's voice.
That you are not suggesting what I think you are suggesting.
I squirmed. Rhys already had his phone out.
Hello, aristocrats, he was saying. This is a bit of a... Well, I've just had a bit of a shock. As you all know, my friend and colleague Luke O'Donnell is getting married soon.
Did you... I seized on the opportunity to claim the moral high ground. Did you announce my wedding on social media without consulting me?
Don't you try to talk your way out of this. The aristocrats are going to want to know why you think we're not good enough for your wedding.
I don't think we'd put it quite like that, I tried. Barbara Clench was glaring at me, which at least felt familiar.
How would you put it?
This one seemed like an easy answer. Well, in your case, I would probably say, we hate each other, so I didn't think you'd want to come. A deathly silence fell over the room. There was a tiny, tiny chance that we both hate each other, right? Wasn't the most tactful thing to say when you'd just driven several hours to attend a co-worker's wedding.
I...
For a while, Barbara couldn't say anything else. Eventually, she managed...
I never thought...
Well, I didn't mean it like...
I knew...
Oh, God. She seemed genuinely shaken up.
That we were sometimes a little... A little short. But I'd always felt that we had a friendly rivalry.
Fuck. I didn't mean it like... Just that I thought you hated me, and that I was sort of riffing on that?
It didn't sound like that was what you were saying,
said Barbara, clinging to Gabriel's hand.
She's right, agreed Rhys. It didn't.
They were both right, because it wasn't. Would it help if I said I was really sorry? Barbara Clench got to her feet.
I think I need a walk.
Her husband got up and went with her, leaving me and Oliver alone, with Rhys and Anna with one N. She can't have... I tried. Then, how did...
Don't look at me, said Rhys. I always thought you two got on.
That made no sense. How could you possibly think that?
Well, you're very similar.
Was it hypocritical to be offended that somebody had compared you to a woman you'd just vehemently denied hating?
We bloody well aren't. You're both rude and think you're better than everybody.
Hey, that is not... I stopped. Probably best to rephrase. I'm nowhere near as bad as I was a couple of years ago. Rhys gave a shrug.
And neither she. But you're still both awful quite a lot of the time.
Words clearly weren't working for me, so I made a grah kind of noise. Oliver, back me up here. I am not an arsehole. With a gentleness that people normally reserved for angry children and frightened dogs, Oliver patted my leg.
You're a wonderful human being, and I love you. But you can be a tiny bit mean sometimes.
Betrayal. Rank betrayal. So can you.
This isn't about him.
Rhys was looking as serious as he was capable of, which wasn't hugely serious.
You're the one who isn't inviting us to your wedding.
It's his wedding too, I pointed out.
And I never said you couldn't invite your work friends,
murmured Oliver, traitorously.
I just thought we agreed we wanted to keep it small.
I wasn't letting Oliver lawyer his way out of this one. How can we keep it small if I invite my entire office?
It's not a very large office, he pointed out.
Exasperated, I turned pleadingly back to Rhys. Why do you even want to come? You can't actually like weddings. No sensible person likes weddings.
Bridget likes weddings,
said Oliver, continuing to jam knives into my spine. Bridget isn't sensible, not where romance is concerned. Oliver gave me a smile that almost made me forget how cross I was with him.
True. She thought we'd be a good couple.
You see? I jabbed my finger at him triumphantly. He's mean as well. We're a mean couple. A couple of mean people who say mean things and are mean to each other.
If it helps,
said Anna with one N.
I agree that weddings mostly suck.
I slumped back in my chair with unexpected relief. Thank you. Why is the only person who has my back the one I've never met before?
Because.
Oliver shuffled around to kneel facing me. He still had that mischievous look on his face that was making it hard to stay pissed off with him.
She's new, and she's trying to make a good impression.
And also,
Anna with one N added,
weddings really do suck.
Rhys was shaking his head.
Oh, no, I love a good wedding, me. Everybody dressing up nice, people being all happy. Only a complete knobhead would have a problem with that.
And now, I turned my jabbing finger toward Rhys, you've just called your girlfriend a complete knobhead. Why am I the bad guy? With her head in Rhys's lap, Anna with one N gave a little shrug.
I suppose because a lot of the time, I can be a complete knobhead.
You see?
Rhys gave a vindicated nod.
A good relationship is based on honesty.
Somehow, I was still outnumbered. Look, I gave up. If it means that much to you, of course you can come to our wedding.
And Alex and Miffy and Barbara and Gabriel and the Professor?
Asked Rhys. Alex and Miffy we'd have been pretty much obliged to invite anyway, since they'd invited us to theirs. To be honest, I was increasingly convinced that weddings were just an elaborate cycle of vengeance that had got really out of hand. Some pair of selfish bastards had forced their friends to come to a tedious party 2,000 years ago, and their selfish bastard friends had decided to pay them back by forcing them to come to a tedious party. And then some wholly independent group of selfish bastards had built an industry around it, and here we were. An eye for an eye leaves the world overpaying for table settings. Yes. I shot a quick, confirmatory glance at Oliver. Although honestly at this stage, if we were stuck with a wedding full of crappers, It was as much his fault as mine, so he'd kind of lost the right to object.
You can all come. It'll be lovely. The more the merrier.
There you go, aristocrats, Rhys said into his phone. Happy ending all around. For more heartwarming content like this, remember to like, share and subscribe to my channel and to follow CRAPP on all of the social medias.
Anna with one N looked up from his lap.
And I'm at Not That Anna, The Other Anna, in all the usual places. And I upload content daily when I'm not having arguments with my boyfriend's colleagues.
And in case you're wondering, Rhys added, I know it seems weird, my channel telling you how to find pictures of my girlfriend's boobies, but I'm fine with it. She's a lovely girl, and it's her job.
He paused for a moment and added,
Also, they're very nice, so if you haven't checked them out, do give them a go.
There wasn't a great deal I could say to that, but fortunately a knock at the door meant I didn't have to.
That'll be the professor, said Rhys.
Or Barbara, I added apprehensively, in which case I should go and apologise. I eased myself reluctantly out of the chair, and when the banging on the door intensified, I tried not to tell myself that it probably was Barbara, because it would be characteristically impatient of her. Still, it wasn't worth putting off any longer, so I quickened my step a little. It wasn't Barbara. It was a man and a woman I didn't recognise, both in their mid-40s. They had a uniformed police officer with them.
Sorry to interrupt, she said, but this couple have just called my station, and they tell me you've broken into their house.